Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, April 10, 2018. A top government official accuses General Paul Malong of committing atrocities during South Sudan's conflict.
All that he did during his time when he was the chief of general staff were atrocities that were beyond anything. He has destroyed the army through corruption.
And a dispute between church leaders prompt authorities to shut down a church in Bor.
It is a rebellion of some leaders in the church who do not want to obey the constitution of the church, who sued in the election and they were defeated, and they want to destroy the church from within.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Government spokesman Michael Makuei says General Paul Malong's rebellion is motivated by political ambition, and he accused Malong of committing atrocities while running the army. The South Sudan government is also downplaying the strength of Malong's South Sudan United Front. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei says the government is not surprised by General Malong's decision to form a rebel movement against the Kiir administration.
We have been monitoring his activities in Nairobi. He had started recruitment and he went to Khartoum, where he also did recruitment. Some of his followers here followed him. And according to our sources, he has now declared his movement to overthrow the government and charging the government of atrocities and corruption.
Makuei says the ex-army chief was removed from his post because he was planning to stage a coup against President Kiir.
One of the reasons we led to his removal was it was observed that he has suspicious activities that may lead to something like what he has declared now. He wanted to make a coup, but the government moved faster than him and he was relieved.
Malong was held under house arrest for several months in Juba and was released for medical reasons in November 2017 and is now in Nairobi. Malong's spokesperson told this program yesterday that the former army chief founded the South Sudan United Front Army to end what he called the suffering of the South Sudanese people and to restore democracy and the rule of law. Makuei dismissed Malong's declarations and says, Malong formed his new movement because of personal grudges against the Kiir administration.
We believe that he was appointed as the chief of general staff for life. Otherwise, his removal is not strange. But for him, it is strange because we believe that he was to continue. And he is charging the government of corruption. Meanwhile, he is stated at the top of the corruption list.
In his statement, Malong accuses the Kiir administration of systemic corruption and carnage committed against the South Sudanese people. But Makuei says Malong himself presided over widespread atrocities.
He is actually at the top of the corruption. He is at top of the atrocities ever committed, because all that he did during his time when he was the chief of general staff were atrocities that were beyond anything. He has destroyed the army through corruption.
Makuei says the Kiir administration will not reach out to Malong and strongly warns him against mounting attacks on government positions. He advises Malong to join the opposition during the next high-level revitalization forum in Addis Ababa. Malong said in his statement that his group will sign the cessation of hostilities agreement which the government and various armed groups signed in December and ask IGAD to include his new group in the coalition of opposition groups negotiating with the government at the next phase of the high-level revitalization forum is scheduled to take place later this month. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio. in Juba.
Jonglei state authorities shut down the main Pentecostal church in Bor town over the weekend following a dispute over leadership positions among rival groups in the church. The bishop of the Sudanic Pentecostal church blames what he calls a rebellious group of pastors for the chaos. Manyang David Mayar has the story for VOA from Juba.
Doors of the Pentecostal church in Bor remained closed on orders of the state police. Bor Police Commander Brigadier General Ajang John says shutting down the church was their last resort after church leaders failed to heed several warnings by the police to resolve their differences peacefully.
Those of Pentecostal church have a dispute between them, and two parties are they to make violence. They came before me, and I told them, "Well, if you agree yourself, you don't have an objection to pray together. If you don't want to pray together to make the insecurity, that one we don't want." They did not agree. That's why we took the decision to close the church for the safety. We don't want the community to fight themselves.
Abraham Cholwell, who supports one of the fighting rival groups, says the dispute began after elections were held for choosing the church's new leaders.
Actually, the problem started in 2012, in the first election, and it happened that those who were in that election, they elected David Lang, the former area overseer of Bor, area board, and is not qualified according to Article 25 of Sudan Pentecostal Church, which says if you become a overseer, you have to have Bible and theology diploma. And the other thing, you have to be a member, ordained person.
Joel says back then, he and other pastors accepted that David Lang would serve a five-year term as the overseer of the Bor Area Board, with the hope that he would not contest in the next elections. But in November, Joel says Lang disputed the outcome of the elections, which sparked massive protest among senior pastors, including himself. Reverend Lang says that's not what happened.
Those things are not they are not in place. Really, there is that election has taken place, and they declined during the election. And I was win the election, of course. Without anybody that stand for that election. So that problem, I think it is not an issue. The issue is this. Israel has claimed the land of the church to be his own. And when he failed to prove that issue, because he has no any document. He went on inside the community, the pastors of community, those who are around the church, and told them that you claim the church because that church is located in your geographical area, so you claim the church to be your own. I think that is the issue. The problem is around that church.
Reverend Isaiah Majukdao is the general overseer of the Sudan Pentecostal Church. Speaking by phone from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Majuk says the Pentecostal Church in Bor is witnessing a rebellion.
The truth is not the unqualification of a leader. It is a rebellion of some leaders in the church who do not want to obey the constitution of the church, who sued in the election and they were defeated. And they want to destroy the church from within. We did reconciliation 3 times, and they are the ones who turned it down.
Reverend Stephen Rech Akwak, who claims to have founded the church in 1992, accuses Majuk of taking sides in the dispute and using Lang to implement his agenda.
Majuk has a jealousy in the name of Bor Area Sport. Now, when we insist not to change the name, chase us away, he turn us as a rebel. When we tell him, okay, if we are rebel, let us go to national board and to discuss this in national board. You cannot change area board to Jonglei. Now, he refused to go to national board. When he refused to national board, we went to Juba. He refused to attend the meeting of national board. He told us we'll go to board to discuss. Now, since that time, he refused to come to board. the church was closed on Sunday because Majuk influenced people here in Bor.
Police Commander John says the church will remain closed until the two sides agree to cooperate and pray together peacefully as children of God. He says the major parties are expected to appear in court before a judge on May 17th in an effort to resolve the dispute amicably. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has started a biometric registration of refugees in northern Uganda to try to verify the actual number of refugees in the country following allegations that officials stole funds meant for refugees, most of whom are South Sudanese. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Allegations of widespread theft of donated aid meant for refugees in Uganda surfaced late last year. Major donors, such as the United States, European Union, and the United Kingdom, threatened to withhold assistance for the program if it was proven Ugandan officials purposely inflated refugee numbers. Uganda responded by suspending four top officials from the Office of the Prime Minister's Department for Refugee Affairs, pending investigations into reports that officials created ghost names to steal donated aid. UNHCR spokesperson in Uganda, Dunia Khan, says it's crucial to verify existing data on registered refugees to restore confidence in the program.
In the past, there has been some complaints about the numbers, and there has been some complaints about assistance not reaching the actual deserving people.
Major donors and the UN Refugee Agency launched their own investigations into the corruption allegations. Khan says it's too early to determine whether or not a deliberate attempt was made to inflate the numbers of refugees.
When, you know, an emergency is at its peak and registration is taking place, so the chances of multiple registrations cannot be ruled out. You have newborn babies, you have people who are passing away.
The process of registering hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda kicked off last week in the Bidibidi settlement in Yumbe district and in Vepi in Arua district. Peter Batali, executive director of the refugee-founded NGO Community Technology Empowerment Network, was in charge of mobilizing refugees to show up for verification. Batali says it was not easy persuading the refugees to turn up.
In fact, that has been the major cause of negativity initially about the verification. They simply look at it as a way of reducing or cutting down the population so that they have less food.
UNHCR and Ugandan officials expect to complete verification of all refugees by September. In the Ivepi settlement in Arua, which has a population of around 128,000 refugees, the registration process began 4 days ago and it is expected to end on June 11th. South Sudanese refugee Rosalia Dogasuk resides at the Ivepi camp. She says she registered the first day and the process was straightforward.
They simply ask questions like, where did you come from? Why did you leave your country?
Batali says his office explains the purpose and importance of the verification exercise to refugees and tells them what to expect during the process. Speaking in Arabic, South Sudanese refugee Joseph Wani says he hopes the process will help reunite some separated families.
The process went well, but the official refused to enroll one of my children, who arrived only last month.
Khan says she hopes the biometric enrollment, which includes scanning a person's iris and fingerprints, will prevent fraud and clear up any doubts about the actual number of refugees in the country.
The final result of verification will answer so many unanswered questions that has been raised since January this year.
Before the corruption allegations surfaced, Uganda was widely praised for its generosity towards refugees and its willingness to host more refugees who were given food, clothing, and small plots of land to resettle. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Pico in Kampala.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, is it possible to have a free trade zone in Africa? We will bring an answer to that question right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there a system for naming the children in your community? Tell us about it.
Here in Uganda, when they are giving you a name, there is what we call a clan name, and each and every clan has its own names. Though some may look to be similar, but they differ in different ways.
In my community, children are named after their grandfathers, normally. But with the upsurge of Christianity now, you can give Christian names, even in the dialect.
Children are named according to where they come from or who has given birth to them. Those from the palace who are princes and princesses have the way they name them. Twins also have a way they name them. Children who are born out of wedlock are different from naming compared to those who are born in marriage.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment, and today we are talking about the progress on world health. Saturday was the 70th anniversary of the World Health Organization. It also marked the World Health Day. VOA's Carol Payson takes a look at what has been accomplished over the past 70 years and what still needs to be done.
Over the past 70 years, the World Health Organization has spearheaded efforts to free the world of killer diseases like smallpox. It has also formed partnerships to end other diseases like polio. Peter Crowley, a former polio team leader at UNICEF, said we are nearing the end of that disease.
We're almost there, this close. 99.9% of polio has been eradicated from the world.
Crowley made the statement in 2014. Since then, polio workers have kept up their effort, despite conflict and hardship. Last year, 17 children contracted the virus, but polio will only be stamped out when no child gets this disease. Access to other life-saving vaccines, like those against measles and a host of other viruses, is out of reach for many people. That's why the World Health Organization declared the theme for this World Health Day, Health for All. James Fitzgerald oversees the development of universal health coverage in the Americas at the Pan American Health Organization, a regional division of the World Health Organization.
Much of the world is talking about universal health coverage at the moment as one of the really global challenges that we have.
But barriers mean 2 out of 3 people in the Americas, as well as half the people in the world, don't have access to health care.
Essentially, the same barriers we see elsewhere. They're geographical, the lack of physical availability of health care institutions. They are what we call institutional, or relation to the organization of the health system, like waiting times, lack of doctors, nurses, etc. They are financial, where there's just not enough money being put into the system, or people have to pay out of pocket. And then there are issues relating to social discrimination within the health systems.
It's a tall order to get countries to invest in national health services. The WHO argues that when people have access to health care, people will live more productive lives, epidemics can be held at bay, and the countries where they live are more likely to prosper. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Now that most African states have signed the Basic Framework Agreement setting up the landmark African Continental Free Trade Area, the work on building its critical elements continues, and several key countries have yet to sign the agreement. VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young discusses the next steps with a top African Union official and economist.
When 44 African leaders gathered in Kigali last month to sign the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, the lavish ceremonies represented more of a cornerstone laying than a ribbon cutting marking completion. Much, it turns out, remains to be done via Skype from Nigeria. Economic research Southern Africa economist Nonso Obikili.
The signing in Kigali was not the establishment of a free trade area, but the signing of a legal framework under which the free trade area will happen. So there's still a lot of protocols to be signed, there's still a lot of negotiations to be had.
Two of Africa's biggest economies have not yet signed the agreement. African Union officials say South Africa's formal approval is expected after Pretoria completes a constitutionally mandated review of the deal. In Nigeria, both the country's Labor Congress and the Manufacturers Association oppose the deal as bad for the country. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will consult again with those groups before moving forward. But a top African Union official says removing tariffs provides greater and more broad-based economic benefits than protectionism offers. Via Skype from Addis Ababa, Commissioner for Trade and Industry Albert Muchanga.
And when that is done, it means that the goods will be much cheaper because there will be less the duty that has been that used to be applied. And that is going to stimulate enhance the production across Africa.
The United Nations estimates that under the deal, African states will lose a collective $4.1 billion in tariff revenue a year. However, it says lower prices will produce what it calls a social benefit to consumers of more than $16 billion annually. Trade between African states amounted to just 10% of the continent's total trade in 2010. The UN's Economic Commission for Africa says that by 2022, the Free Trade Pact could increase inter-African trade by up to 52%. Much of Africa was liberated from colonialism more than a half century ago, but some old practices remain. The chairman of the Institute of Economic Affairs says Africa's development depends on open commerce, not protectionism and favoritism. From Accra via Skype, Charles Mensah.
What we are doing now is practicing the same old mercantilist economy, the colonial economy, where our government creates rents for business people to extract.
With this free trade pact, African states essentially give up part of their sovereignty to enjoy collective benefits. And that, according to some regional analysts, emotionally goes against the fierce nationalism that drove their gaining freedom. Jeffrey Young, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move to Israel, where about 40,000 Africans are facing an uncertain future as the Israeli government resumes efforts to deport them. Robert Berger has this report for VOA from Jerusalem.
African migrants have been on a roller coaster ride since last week when the Israeli government did an about face. First, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that Israel had reached a compromise with the UN Refugee Agency. Under the deal, some 16,000 Africans would be sent to Western countries, while more than 20,000 would be allowed to remain in Israel. The migrants were elated, but not for long. Netanyahu abruptly canceled the agreement the next day after his right-wing coalition partners demanded that all the Africans be deported. The government rejects claims the Africans are refugees, describing them as economic migrants and infiltrators. Most of the migrants arrived in Israel from war-torn Eritrea and Sudan during the past decade.
Teklit
Mikhael, a 29-year-old asylum seeker from Eritrea, says he does not know where he can work legally, he does not have a permanent place to live, and he fears being deported or thrown in jail. Some Israelis blame the migrants for rising crime and poverty in South Tel Aviv and accuse them of threatening the Jewish character of the state. So the government is trying to revive a plan to send them to a third country in Africa after Uganda backed out of a deal to take them in because it could not guarantee their safety. Israeli human rights lawyer Avigdor Feldman says the government's policy is legally and morally unacceptable. He says sending people to African countries where their lives would be in danger is a violation of international law. He adds that Israel has an ethical obligation to offer the Africans asylum because Jews were refugees during the Holocaust. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Labia Maru by Mede Muzika.
Olena Marie, Vonandre Nandero, Cecilia.
Labia Maru, Nimiketi Amaru.
Atane Morosi.
Olena Maria, Somururu Nye, Vonandre.
Tiso Ingine Dese.
Oso Hati Amabesi na Mururu Nye.
Limingo.
Utane Jine Oso Nga.
Mondo lobe na toro fashe
Azifu Uni takachina rube Uni takachina rube
Tika tatara luku de
Labi amaru
Minga kuru
Mikechi amaru
Belenwa
Walebe amari osomuru nye Fona onene
Daniel Faro Jadobe
Meri Musugu Maria Tirutono Si Oso Eto Fayaronye
Teideru
Anjo Kotuninga Peri Selu Kozobe Mururi Dei Menga
Niwa
Mabidri Mono Kwaro Bayaru Behuri
Kete Para
Lupa Moruto Nemi Munre Yasi
Buaichi
Nuyindi Bangulwe Diko Laka Madindi Yeri Kedi bala nyende mambolo singo wandi barita pari
Jambo amati agu kotobi
Apanda naru nga kidine Ogu osane agu apana marayasi
Bari.
Iza chuaru obane Agu pati biafune Nini epe onrebe taro yasi
Kutuano
Labi amaru nini kechi amaru
Dangye la sebe furu
Walena amari oso mururu
Kama lu
ujuti mo
ritu fagona Nisho bongo, onteko, ongo osozona Damo, dewiki onteko, bas mas Konyo sine pidisi
Iduka wot Murunu nyakwanje dana di pekidisi Iduka wot
Asite kuso Tore
Mule kundre Isa wisi
Ngoba
Asite kuso bibiri Mule kundre Isa wisi
Iti
Tibi lurundi awi na be
Chano
Tibi lurundi awi na be Isa chua ruko nga be
Amata
Jambali hushi Isa chua ruko nga be
We have been listening to Mede Musica with the song Labi Amaro. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Drop us a line on what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also reach us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Something.